One day in August of 1861, two men got off the overland stage at Carson City, capital of the newly created territory of Nevada. They're the Clemens brothers, Orion and Samuel. Coming cross country from Missouri, they were surprised at the landscape before them, a tiny little town with hardly more than a few buildings, smack in the middle of a vast and mountainous desert. They came to this little dot on the map for jobs. Orion Clemens had been appointed Nevada's secretary, second in command to the governor, who, like most politicians, was back east, much more concerned with the outbreak of the war between the states. After several business failures, the 36-year-old needed the work. But young Sam Clemens, who had been well employed piloting steamboats on the Mississippi River, had another reason to come west.
He was a pilot and loved that role.
Robert Hurst is general editor and curator of the Mark Twain Project at the University of California at Berkeley.
The Civil War shuts down the river because it's a strategic element, right? The only kind of navigation that's going on the river are war boats. And Clemens was quite clear that he did not want to be a pilot on a war steamship because, of course, a pilot sits in this little glass case up on top of the boat and is a pretty good target, and he really had no appetite for war.
Their Nevada jobs didn't pay much, and Sam Clemens was soon lured by the fantastic thing happening practically in his backyard. At the nearby Comstock Lode, fortunes in gold and silver were being made almost daily, and he couldn't resist. He headed for the mining camps, outfitted himself for prospecting, and tried his luck. A new line of work was nothing new for Sam Clemens. Back in Missouri, before he had gotten his license to pilot steamboats, he worked as a typesetter in print shops, including one owned by his older brother. There, he became a voracious reader and sometime writer. He had a rather combative nature and exercised it in occasionally producing an outrageous story when his boss was out of town. So now here he was in the hills of Nevada in 1862, and in between shifts scouring the mountains for precious metals, Sam Clemens kept little notebooks full of stories he heard and descriptions of the colorful characters he met. From his notes, he began putting together stories and sending them to a little newspaper in Virginia City, Nevada, called the Territorial Enterprise.
A petrified Shaw was found some time ago in the mountains south of Gravelly Ford. Every limb and feature of the stone mummy was perfect, not even excepting the left leg, which had evidently been a wooden one during the lifetime of the owner, which lifetime, by the way, came to a close about a century ago, in the opinion of a savant who has examined the defunct.
The writing was well received, but the prospecting was a failure. And after enough of Sam's bad bets on mining claims depleted his savings, he turned to writing, this time not as a hobby, but to make a living. In a play called Sam and Laura, about Clemens and one of his early love interests, Pulitzer Prize and Emmy Award winner Ron Powers dramatized the first day Sam Clemens introduced himself to the editor of the Enterprise.
This here, the Territorial Enterprise. Mm-hmm. Which one of you jaybirds is good? I'm Sam Clemens, reporting for work.
I'm Joe Goodman. Are you here to work for us or to stick us up?
I reckon after I'm here a while, you won't be able to tell the difference.
The Enterprise was one of the many chatty and lively little papers of the times. It thrived on hyperbole and controversy, and Sam Clemens fit right in. In a story that appeared in December of 1862, the new reporter wrote of a rather rollicking party for members of the Nevada legislature.
The supper and the champagne were excellent and abundant, and I offer no word of blame against anybody for eating and drinking pretty freely. When I went to bed this morning, Mr. Lovejoy, arranged in fiery red nightclothes, was dancing the war dance of his tribe. He is president of the Paiute Association, around a spittoon. And Colonel Howard, dressed in a similar manner, was trying to convince him that he was a humbug. A suspicion crossed my mind that they were partially intoxicated.
Newspaper reporters of the time usually worked without a byline, and if a writer indulged in commentary, he usually wrote with a pen name. Sam Clemens had a few different noms de plume, but after several months at the Enterprise, he gave himself one he would never change, Mark Twain, after the old steamboat task of dropping a line into the water to mark the depth of the river. That name gave him anonymity and the freedom to sometimes, shall we say, stretch the truth, as he did constantly in the Territorial Enterprise.
About 7 o'clock Tuesday evening, a sudden blast of wind picked up a shooting gallery, two whorehouses, and a drugstore, and set them down some 10 or 12 feet from their original location. There were many guests at the whorehouses at the time. It is pleasant to reflect that they seized their luggage and vacated the premises with an alacrity suited to the occasion. Is there one single solitary goddamn fact in this piece?
I believe I found one in the first draft. I cut it out.
Credit!
As Mark Twain, Clemens began sending reports, sketches, and commentary on life in Nevada, not only to the Enterprise, but to publications in California. The stories were entertaining and sometimes quite controversial. Twain was making a name for himself. He was promoted to city editor, but it wasn't long before his feisty prose got him into a very nasty literary rumble with a rival newspaper man in Virginia City. Just how bad things got between the two is described by Robert Hurst of the Mark Twain Project.
And at one point, another newspaper editor insults Clemens, or feels that Clemens feels that he insults him, and Clemens insults him back, and then he sends a challenge to this guy, and the guy sends another challenge back, and then another challenge. And these are all very heated and very extreme expressions of disapproval, let's put it that way. They're all illegal as well. That is to say, even to carry a challenge in Nevada at the time was illegal. If you were convicted, you would be in prison for it. Nevertheless, this is all taking place very much in public, and when the other editor doesn't respond as Clemens wants him to, he publishes the whole correspondence in the Enterprise. So it's very, very, very public. And at that point, there's a duel that's about to take place, and it almost does take place. But he and his friend Steve Gillis, who was acting as his second, get wind that the governor's out to imprison them. And so they pack up pretty fast and leave for San Francisco.
I was looking for a job out there in San Francisco, but I was very particular about the kind of job I would get. I didn't want to work. So I became a newspaper reporter.
He found a job with one of the city's five major newspapers, The Call. He'd been their Nevada correspondent, and they made him a staff reporter.
It's about 1863. He has this radar for being at the right place at the right time.
That's Ron Powers, like Twain, a native of Hannibal, Missouri. Before writing the play Sam and Laura, he authored one of the most acclaimed of the 40 biographies of Mark Twain, Mark Twain, A Life. He explains that as a newcomer in San Francisco, the young journalist quickly became part of the city's growing colony of raffish writers and artists.
He walks into the dawn of the counterculture in San Francisco. They called themselves Bohemians back then. And he met Bret Hart.
Never a tear bedims the eye, but time and patience will not dry.
He met Adela Isaacs Menken, who was the wild Madonna of her time.
Never a lip is curved with pain that can't be kissed into smiles again.
He met all of these eccentric, wild, zany, gifted artists and dancers and poets, and he learned from them. He sort of took their point of view, the skepticism toward mainstream culture, made it his own, and I think it was really San Francisco and Nevada that was his finishing school as an American writer.
Inspired by this group of innovators, Sam Clemens was becoming something new. He was beginning to make American literature speak in the voices of real people. Ron Powers.
Way out west, there were no rules, and that was wonderful because you could hear the common language spoken by common people, gamblers, miners, Chinese railroad workers, cutthroats, gunslingers, and Sam got it all.
As he did in his first book, Roughing It, published in 1871.
We changed horses every 10 miles, all day long, and fairly flew over the hard, level road. After supper, a woman got in who lived about 50 miles farther on. Apparently, she was not a talkative woman. She would sit there in the gathering twilight and fasten her steadfast eyes on a mosquito rooting into her arm. And slowly, she would raise her other hand till she had got his range, and then she would launch a slap at him that would have jolted a cow. I sat by this grim sphinx and watched her kill 30 or 40 mosquitoes. Watched her and waited for her to say something, but she never did. So I finally opened the conversation myself. I said, "The mosquitoes are pretty bad about here, madam." "You bet." "What did I understand you to say, madam?" "You bet." Then she cheered up and faced around and said, "Danged if I didn't begin to think you fellas were deep and dumb. I did, my gosh. Here I've sot and sot and sot and busting mosquitoes and wondering what was ailing you. First I thought you was deep and dumb. Then I thought you was sick or crazy or something. Then by and by I began to reckon you was a passel of sickly fools that couldn't think of nothing to say. Where'd you come from?" The Sphinx was a Sphinx no more. The fountains of her great deep were broken up, and she reigned the nine parts of speech 40 days and 40 nights, metaphorically speaking, and buried us under a desolating deluge of trivial gossip that left not a crag or pinnacle of rejoinder projecting above the tossing waste of dislocated grammar and decomposed pronunciation. She never did stop again until she got to her journey's end near daylight.
It wasn't only the characters and dialect that made Twain so appealing. It was often the poetry in his prose.
He had a fantastic ear for the spoken word. I always thought that he heard language as music.
As he did with the classic character in his masterpiece, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, published in 1884.
"We catched fish and talked, and we took a swim now and then to keep off sleepiness. It was kind of solemn, drifting down the big, still river, laying on our backs, looking up at the stars. And we never feel like talking loud, and it weren't often that we laughed. Only a little, kind of low chuckle. We had mighty good weather as a general thing, and nothing ever happened to us at all. That night, nor the next, nor the next."
Many scholars regard Huckleberry Finn, with its empathetic relationship between a white adolescent and a black runaway slave, to be a subversive book in a time of Jim Crow. And in later years, hypocritical religion, unbridled patriotism, and imperialism were frequent targets of Mark Twain's invective.
"I am said to be a revolutionist in my sympathies, by birth, by breeding, and by principle. I am always on the side of the revolutionists, because there never was a revolution unless there were some oppressive and intolerable conditions against which to revolute."
Those words appeared in the New York Tribune in 1906. By then, Mark Twain was an American icon. But some 40 years earlier, he had to struggle just to keep his day job. As it turned out, Twain and the San Francisco Call were not a comfortable marriage. He wasn't very good at his dry and tedious assignments, writing up sessions of police court, board of education meetings, and the shipping business. But even these articles, as scholars have collected them, sometimes bear the unmistakable twist that was Mark Twain's stock in trade.
"Judgments were given for plaintiffs in the justices' court and an appeal also in the county court. The company have appealed to the Supreme Court solely on a point of jurisdiction. Like Jarndyce and Jarndyce in Chancery, The steamship plaintiffs will probably bequeath these suits to their children of a long succession of future generations, for it is hardly possible that they themselves will live long enough to see one of them through its endless career in the United States Supreme Court.
But while Twain wrote mostly colorless stuff for The Call, he sent many provocative pieces back to the Territorial Enterprise as their San Francisco correspondent. Some reflected Twain's interest in social justice, including stories criticizing the San Francisco police for harsh treatment of the denizens of Chinatown. When they found out about the articles from friends in Nevada, the police were not at all pleased with Mark Twain, a.k.a. Sam Clemens, and that led to the end of his stay in the city by the bay. Within 5 months, the man who would become the most famous of all American writers was fired from the San Francisco Call. Soon, the cops were after him for another reason, and again, Clemens's best friend, Steve Gillis, was involved. He had gotten into a bar fight and was thrown in jail. Clemens had bailed him out with a straw bond, a pledge that if his friend did not show up in court, Clemens himself would suffer the consequences. When Steve Gillis decided he'd rather go to his brother Jim's cabin in the Sierra foothills than go to court, Sam Clemens was forced to leave town, too, to avoid going to jail. It was the winter of 1864.
I spent 3 months in the log cabin home of Jim Gillis and his par Dick Stoker and Jackass Gulch, that serene and reposeful and dreamy and delicious sylvan paradise.
A paradise of pouring rain, anyway. Jim Gillis, Dick Stoker, and Sam Clemens were pretty much confined indoors. Remember now, it's the mid-19th century. There were no electronic diversions, no radio, no television, no movies or computers, none of that. People entertained themselves. And as it happened, Jim Gillis was a master storyteller. And when he weaved through his repertoire, out came Clemens's notebook.
Every now and then, Jim would have an inspiration. And he would stand up before the great log fire with his back to it and his hands crossed behind him and deliver himself an elaborate impromptu lie, a fairy tale, an extravagant romance.
In between the rain and the stories, Jim Gillis and his guests were miners, scouring the hills in search of a rich strike. And that search took them from the cabin to a nearby village in pursuit of a promising mining claim there.
They went to Angel's Camp, and then the weather really turned bad, really wet, muddy.
Victor Fisher is an editor with the Mark Twain Project at Berkeley.
And they were very much stuck either in the place they were staying or in the bars. And they went to the bars a lot. And in those bars were some great talkers, some of whom wrote stories and talked in a fashion that Clemens tried to capture. He wrote little notes to himself in his notebook about using some of these things. And one of the stories was became Jim Smiley and his jumping frog.
The story is about a hustler who gets hustled.
He was the curious man about, always betting on anything that turned up you ever see. If he could get anybody to bet on the other side, and if he couldn't, he'd change sides. Any way that suited the other man would suit him. Anyway, just so he's got a bet, he was satisfied.
Twain's story was first published by the New York Saturday Press in 1865.
He was always ready and laying for a chance. There could be no solitary thing mentioned, but that feller'd offered to bet on it. And take any side you please, as I was just telling you. If there was a horse race, you'd find him flush, or you'd find him busted at the end of it. If there was a dog fight, he'd bet on it. If there was a cat fight, he'd bet on it. If there was a chicken fight, he'd bet on it. Why, if there were two birds setting on a fence, he would bet you which one would fly first.
The story was well received. It appeared in many newspapers and magazines. And what was first called Jim Smiley and His Jumping Frog came to be known under another title, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. Suddenly, Mark Twain was getting much notice nationally, and he finally came to grips with the fact that writing, nothing else, was his destiny. He explained that in a letter to his family dated October 19th, 1865.
I've never had but two powerful ambitions in my life. One was to be a pilot, and that other a preacher of the gospel. I accomplished the one and failed in the other, because I could not supply myself with the necessary stock in trade, i.e. religion. I have given it up forever. I never had a call in that direction anyhow, and my aspirations were the very ecstasy of presumption. But I have had a call to literature of a low order, i.e. humorous.
By age 35, Mark Twain's fame was spreading rapidly. But there were those who opposed him. The prominent writers known as the Boston Brahmins saw his work as crude, pushing the nascent American literature in the wrong direction. Ron Powers.
They had a lot of influence. If you wanted to be an American writer, and if you lived in the East, you'd better write like the Brahmins wrote, or you wouldn't get published.
But Twain's approach found converts, especially the critic and writer William Dean Howells, an advocate of realism, and the protests of the group that included Ralph Waldo Emerson, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Oliver Wendell Holmes could not block out the immense contributions of Mark Twain.
So he brought this rough, tough, authentic, truth-telling language back east with him from California and was able to convince some of the gatekeepers of the high culture that he really had something to say, despite the fact that he smoked cigars and had sagebrush on his pants and didn't talk very nice. And in that way, I really believe that Mark Twain completed the American Revolution. He took the language away from the old world Brahmins and gave it back to the common people.
In a strong sense, the rest, as they say, is history. Lucrative offers for his writing and lecturing began to pour in, and Sam Clemens left the West to live in Washington and then New York. He eventually settled in Hartford, Connecticut, where he became one of the most productive and famous of all Americans.
Robert Louis Stevenson and I, sitting in Union Square and Washington Square a great many years ago, tried to find a name for the submerged fame. That fame that permeates the great crowd of people you never see and never mingle with. People with whom you have no speech, but who read your books and become admirers of your work and have an affection for you. You may never find it out in the world, but there it is. And it is the faithfulness of the friendship, of the homage of those men, never criticizing, that began when they were children. They have nothing but compliments. They never see the criticisms. They never hear any disparagement of you. And you will remain in the home of their heart's affection forever and ever. And Louis Stevenson and I decided that of all fame, that was the best.